Yeah, that's sort of better.
It's more authoritative.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Finance. I apologize for the delay. We were on the Senate floor until 3 a.m. this morning, so I apologize for those of you who whose schedules were disrupted by the postponement of the earlier meeting today. It is Monday, April 18th. Yes, it is, 2016. The time is 3:36 p.m. This is the Senate Finance Committee meeting. We are in Alaska State Capitol here in Juneau, room 532. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. Welcome, Vice Chairman Michicki.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Good afternoon, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
You do understand that's my one thing to do each day to get you guys going is not do exactly the same around the table every time. Just want to make sure you're noting that. Right now, on other state business is Senator Dunleavy as well as Senator Kelly. We hope that they'll be joining us, but actually I see Senator Dunleavy walking in right now. So welcome, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Kelly is away on other state business. Is there anything else to come before the committee? Online is Nikos Saphos from Analytica, Washington, D.C. He's going to cover the first three slides in our packet. If Janik Mayer would join us at the microphone. Mr. Mayer, if you could identify yourself, and then we'll move to Nikos.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Janik Mayer, Chairman of Analytica. Thank you.
Mr. Saphos, are you there?
I am, Madam Chair. This is Nikos Saphos, President of Analytica, for the record. Thank you very much for having us back, and thank you very much for allowing me to testify from a distance. I wanted to start off with slide 25 as we move into Cook Inlet. What we wanted to do is split this up into two parts. One is talk a little about the market, mostly the gas market, more generally the oil and gas market of Cook Inlet. And then I'm going to go through about three slides, and then we're going to switch it over to Janik, and he's going to look essentially at the project economics of some sample projects that we have modeled to try to figure out essentially, you know, what is the economic impact of the proposed changes. So I'm going to start off with slide 25, and this is a very simple slide. There's two pictures here on the left. There's exploration activity on the right is development activity. And what you can see is that broadly speaking, the Cook Inlet Recovery Act and the recent years have caused a reaction in terms of activity. On the exploration side, you can see that there's been a number of cycles over the years going back to even before, statehood. And that this recent up cycle is, you know, one of the better ones in sort of a 50, 60-year horizon. On the development side, which is merely showing when a well produced its first oil or first gas, it's even the up cycle recently is even more impressive than your sort of, I'm looking at the 3-year average here just to smoothen a little bit the volatility, and that uptick on the right, on the red line, you can see it's one of the better moments that the state has had. So in a big picture, it's fair to say that what the state has done has triggered an impact. It's triggered an impact on the exploration side. It's triggered an impact on the development side. There's no disputing that. What we want to do is try to figure out exactly what has happened in slightly more detail and then try to think about the economic impact of changing the fiscal system. And with that, I'm going to switch over to the next slide, slide 26. What's interesting here is that I think, a lot of the conversation always revolves around gas and the impending gas shortage that was forecasted a few years ago, the change, the turnaround, the sort of changed perception about what the market looks like. But it's also interesting when you look at the data to note that there's actually been a clear oil turnaround. Right? That if you look at oil production on the left-hand side, obviously at a huge peak in the sort of early 70s, long-term decline, stabilization, don't need to go through every sub-period here. But essentially since 2009, when production was about 7,500 barrels a day, we've had a huge upturn since then, essentially going from about 7,500 to 18,000 barrels a day. So I think it's important in the conversation that we're having, because we always, or we tend to in the public dialogue, frame everything in the context of gas supply for South Central, to note that when it comes to released hydrocarbons coming out of the ground, the change has been a lot more pronounced on the oil side than on the gas side. Turning to gas, that's the slide on the right, what you have is we have three lines here. Gross production is essentially what comes out of the ground. Net production is what finds its way to the market. And then there's gas that was reinjected, and that was mostly at this field, the Swanson River. And we showed these three lines because I think it's interesting to look at this picture, because oftentimes folks look at the yellow line, the net production line, and then say, you know, there's been sort of a steady increase over time, essentially a plateau that begins sort of in the early to mid-90s that lasts for about 10 years, and then a decline. And that's the story that you see if you look at net production. If you look at gross production, what you see is a slightly different story, which is that gross production really shot up and reached essentially a peak in the late 70s and kind of was flat. And then in the sort of mid-1990s, you had essentially what we call a blowdown, which is taking the gas out of Swanson River. And so gross production, which is how much gas was being produced, was really falling, but you were pulling gas out of Swanson River. So the market, in a way, remained well-supplied even at a time where geologically it had reached a period of decline. And what's interesting is that if you look at the last few years, you see essentially a stabilization. You don't see really an upturn of the type that you see on the oil side. Now, obviously, one could say, well, we were expecting bigger decline, and so that's a very fair observation. But we think this picture of really understanding oil versus gas is helpful, in particular in trying to figure out exactly what the state has gotten out of its very serious investment in the Cook Inlet through the tax system over the last few years. So with that said, I wanted to go to slide 27. And just as an aside, you know, we have a long appendix in the back if folks want to get into the weeds of, you know, what, where, which fields, you know, where does this all come from. You know, broadly speaking, on the oil side, this was driven by workovers, so essentially wells that have been producing for a very long time that folks went in and sort of re-drilled and repaired and were able to get more out of it. On the gas side, it was sort of a mix of new wells being drilled in existing fields as well as some new fields. And so there's some detail about that in the appendix that we can get into. It's going to become a little bit relevant in understanding the market context in which we are building the economic forecast for those three projects that Janet was talking about, right? And they mirror a little bit the type of activity that has taken place in the end of the last few years. And so with that, I want to sort of then look a little bit forward and try to say, okay, well, this is what has happened, what is going to happen. For that, I want to switch to slide 27. And again, there's more detail in the appendix that we're happy to get into it if there is interest. As we said, on the oil side, there's been a rebound. On the gas side, there's been a stabilization. But more generally, I think it's important to understand that a lot of what's happening in the Cook Inlet is a major transition that is fairly common in hydrocarbon basins. I mean, you have essentially a large net exporting basin which matures over time, turns into essentially self-sufficient, and that transition is often painful on a number of places. On the supply side, there's obviously less supply. On the flexibility side, in the past, wells were very good, they were productive. It was pretty easy to turn them up and down to meet seasonality of demand in Alaska. On the demand side, you had both the LNG facility as well as the agri facility, and so they were major consumers, and so therefore they smoothened out a little bit the seasonal volatility. You know, you can imagine if you have a market where every consumer is a residential consumer, you can imagine that the market is very volatile. But if you have a market where, you know, a third is residential and two-thirds are industrial, you can imagine that the overall seasonality of that market is much lower, right? So what has happened is that by taking out LNG and by taking out the nitrogen facility, you've made the market a lot more seasonal just at the time that the supply is not able to provide that flexibility. Obviously, on the competition side, you've had a transition from some of the older, more international players to smaller, more focused players. And then, of course, expectations. You know, one of the things that's pretty obvious is, you know, you had a business where folks were able to sign 10, 20-year contracts that provided all the flexibility they wanted, and then suddenly you transitioned to an environment where suppliers were unable or unwilling to commit to anything more than a few years out, and that's a major shock. It's a shock that we've seen in other markets. Transitioning from long-term contracts to shorter-term contracts is a painful adjustment at times because it forces both the suppliers as well as the buyers to adapt and to try to make do and create sort of risk mitigation mechanisms that they didn't have before, including, for instance, the gas storage facility that Alaska has developed. So in many ways, what we're trying to say here is that a lot of this stuff is pretty common. We see that in a lot of places. We see this kind of transition. Some of them are a little bit more unique to the Cook Inlet in terms of the presence of both, you know, a big nitrogen as well as LNG facility. There were some specific instances of, you know, the RCA sort of Henry Hub decision that kind of disrupted a little bit the pricing transition from one system to the other. But in general, there's nothing that has happened here that we haven't seen in other places around the world. So how do we think about this market sort of playing out? And what is the market context in which we think it's appropriate to understand the fiscal conversation that we have? Well, you know, the market, last year, the Cook Inlet produced about 100 BCF, okay, 100 billion cubic feet, of which about, you know, 13 to 15, depending on the year, over the last few years, have gone for export. So the local market is about 85 BCF. And so the Department of Natural Resources, in its latest estimate, says, you know, there's about 1.2 TCF of gas in the Cook Inlet in 2P reserves. And there's 1.6 TCF if you add Cosmopolitan and Kitchener Life. And these are sort of ballpark figures. They're not figures based on any proprietary information that DNR has, at least as we understand it. So, you know, you look at that number and you say, well, even if I did a simple division of 1,600 divided by 100, just to keep the numbers round, it's 16 years. Now, obviously, you can't produce a field and then, you know, on December 31st, it goes from 100 to zero. You can't do that, right? There's a natural decline. But if you look at that, you say, well, even with 1,200 BCF, somewhere between 1,200 and 1,600 BCF, a market that's about 85 BCF, it seems that there's kind of like enough gas for a decade, plus or minus, right, depending on the level of investment, depending on how demand grows and all that. When we look at it, it looks like a market that has turned a corner in terms of the acute perceptions of gas shortage. At the same time, and this is the paradoxical part as we'll talk about it, it's not necessarily a system that is the supply base, at least the current supply base is 12 and 1600, doesn't seem like it's able to support a major additional demand source, right? Because you kind of look at this and you say, well, even with 85, which is current demand, 85 BCF, you're barely above, you know, 10 years. You know, if you add something major to that, you know, that really shortens the horizon, right? And so you need new reserves to be developed in order to enable that. Which is a long way of saying that in the grand scheme of things, the way we've looked at modeling project economics, what we've looked at is essentially three scenarios, and Janet will get into the economics of that, but I just want to put the market context as to how we thought about these scenarios, which is that essentially you have three types of possibilities if you have gas in the Cook Inlet. The ideal is that, you know, the market is there, and you're able to produce a field and bring as much gas as you need online and develop this optimally. The problem is that the gas market in the Cook Inlet is not big enough to do that, and it's already well supplied. We have, you know, folks who have current contracts that meet their needs. And so it's hard for you to just kind of come in and develop a massive resource because there isn't really a market for that. There isn't really space for you to play. And so given that context, what's more possible to happen is that you develop a field in sort of phases, right? And you bring something online, you capture a little bit of the market, and then as some of the other older fields decline, you capture a little bit more of the market, and then as the older stuff declines further, you capture a little bit more, and you do this in phases. And we've seen some examples of that, and Janik will talk about them in the project cases. But that sort of matches a little bit the reality of the curriculum right now. And then finally, you have, as we said before, when you look at that stabilization of production on the gas side over the last 3-4 years, most of it has come from drilling new wells at existing fields, right? And, you know, essentially, so you have an operation, you just kind of drill an additional 1, 2, 3, 4 wells, and you get more gas out of that. And so our conclusion, and then Janik will sort of back this up as we go into the next few slides, is that our current gas price levels, which is about prevailing value, about $6 per MCF, Bakken's investment is we think, highly profitable, even when you make some tweaks to the fiscal system. Where it really gets trickier is when you're dealing with newer resources, and especially if you're dealing with the kind of demand constraints that we're talking about. Now, obviously, there are market ways to deal with that, right? If it doesn't work, you can raise the price. If it doesn't work, you can try to cut costs and try to find savings. I mean, we live in a highly deflationary environment when it comes to cost for oil and gas, and so that's another scenario. But broadly speaking, when we did sort of a more base case analysis, and Janik will show this, it's kind of tough because the market is so limited to develop a new resource in an optimal and economically profitable way. And the last thing I would say, just before we get into the details of the economics of the project, at the same time, it's also fairly clear to us that the current system is just not seen by the players as sustainable, right? And so regardless of what the new system is, the current system, no one thinks that the system is going to be around for another, you know, 3, 4, 5 years in order to make decisions today based upon this system. And when you don't know something, obviously you always try to assume the worst because you want to be protected as an investor. And that this uncertainty is really causing a lot of harm. And so I think trying to figure something out that is more sustainable is essential to keep this level of activity, even more so than exactly where you set it. If you set, you know, this parameter to 10% or 20%, if it phases out over 3 years or 2.5 years, what's even more important is having something that people can look at and think, you know what, this is sustainable for the procurement, and it's also sustainable for the state, right? Because that's obviously the number one thing that people are looking at is not the procurement, is look at the state finances, right? And try to figure out, you know, is this something the state can afford, or is this something that the state is going to come back after a few years and revisit? So that's the market context in which we wanted you to think about the specific project we have modeled. And with that, I'm going to take a little pause in case we want to get into any of these points more. Otherwise, I'm going to defer to Janik to walk us through the project economics of the type that we have modeled.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Machicki.
Hello, Mr. Sofos. Question for you. I mean, it would be great if you had a computer program where you plug in, you know, 300% of Henry Hub's market price for cooking with gas, and you could sort of determine what potential demand may be if you could increase anchor tenants, if you would, and also apply what you, or have the output be what you thought a credit regime may look like in Cook Inlet to encourage a specific level of production in the future. What kind of value is there in the $6.50 or $6 gas? And how would, say, a new player looking at Cook Inlet, if credits were somewhat more dramatically reduced, could we draw someone that's currently, you know, in a flooded market in the lower 48 or elsewhere to that basin with significantly reduced credits for exploration and development?
Senator Machika, through the chair, for the record, Nico Stavros. That's a very good question. Here's kind of how I think about this, right? You have multiple ways to attract investments and to develop a better functioning market in the Cook Inlet, which is ultimately what a lot of this is about, right? You want to have competition, you want to have security of supply, you want to have multiple players and all these things together. When I look at this and in today's environment, you know, I mean, not a lot of people are making $6 around the world on their gas. And so that's a good price signal, right? It's a very good price signal. I think there's a lot of producers around the world that would kill to get $6 gas. At the same time, you have, as we've shown, a relatively generous fiscal system in terms of its credit as well as, you know, the lack of really taxation at a substantial level. So when I think about that, you know, this is probably not the right way to phrase it, but we've almost sort of supercharged the system, right? Because you have a fairly good price signal, again, in today's market environment, and you have a very generous credit. Now, obviously, the credits, no one really thinks that they're going to be at this level for a long time, so the credits are not useful in attracting investment right now, right? They have been useful. I don't think they're useful right now. But, you know, on a very intuitive level, we said this, I think, in previous testimony as well. You know, when I look at the world and I look at countries that are trying to get producers to develop the most difficult gas, you usually hear that they're trying to go to $5, $6, $7, $8, and those are the kind of prices that they are offering to investors to make some of the most difficult, you know, deep water gas offshore with long pipelines, with production sharing contracts that have relatively strict higher government take. You know, those are the kind of prices that they're offering, right? So intuitively, and you'll see some of these numbers when we get to Janek's details on the project level, intuitively, I think that it's hard to not make money at $6 if you have a good project. The challenge, I think, comes in the fact it's not the price, it's what you multiply the volume with. Right? So you can earn $6, but if you don't have volume to really produce the field out, you can't really take advantage of the high price. And when I look at volume, you know, what you have now is essentially a well-balanced market. There's two options for a new supplier. You either have to go create demand, for example, Agrium, right, or LNG, or you just have to either compete with the existing suppliers or wait until the existing suppliers get depleted, right? At some point, you know, the existing supply is not going to be able to produce as much and it's going to create a wedge and you try to grab that. You know, obviously none of these things are fantastic outcomes, right? It's not a great outcome when you tell someone, sorry, you have to wait back in line for another 5 years before anything can happen. That's not a great outcome. It may be one outcome. It may be better to say, let's try to incentivize demand. At the same time, when you look at the amount of gas that a project like Agrium would use, you know, which is about, you know, 30 BCF, 28 to 41, just forget that, we don't need to go there. It's another, essentially 30 BCF per train, and they're hoping to do two trains. So suddenly, you've almost kind of like doubled the demand of the Cook Inlet. And so if we actually do believe that there's only 12 to 16 BCF of gas, then you just look at a much faster decline rate. So I think it's a little bit of needing to create demand, but you also need more supply to meet that demand. Otherwise, you know, and I hate to say this, but in the way that the market functions right now, the most logical outcome is for the new fields to sort of have to wait in line until there's a big enough wedge created for them in order to compete. And there are places in the world that create this wedge arbitrarily through regulation. They say, for instance, that no, you have to buy a certain amount of gas from new suppliers in order to create this market. So there are ways to get to that. But that lies at the heart of the challenge, I think, that you're facing the Cook Inlet.
Thank you, Mr. Staffos. We have about 15 minutes on Cook Inlet, and then if we could make appointments with individual committee members tomorrow to cover the history and the knobs that are associated with our tax, current taxing structure on both the North Slope and the Cook Inlet. That would be helpful for that time to be spent with Mr. Mayor. Mr. Mayor, could you give us, again, 15 minutes worth of the project constraints and assumptions that are in your following slides?
Madam Chair, absolutely. I think we can get through that fairly easily in 15 minutes. To frame the discussion, I want to go back to the point we made at the very outset when we started talking, I think, on Thursday last week about the contrast between the situation on the North Slope and the situation in the Cook Inlet. What we said there was that, you know, while there was clearly a major problem for the state overall in the amount of credit outflow, that when we looked at those two situations, they were very different. When we looked back, for instance, at this most recent fiscal year we have historical numbers for, FY 2015, that was a world of more than $2 billion in total revenues, restricted and unrestricted, on the North Slope, and only about $224 million in credit outflow, versus, for instance, well under $100 million in revenues from the Cook Inlet, but more than $400 million in credits being spent in the Cook Inlet. One way to put that number into context is to think about 100 BCF, roughly, gas market, which means, you know, you could physically buy more than 80% of the Cook Inlet gas with the amount of credits that were spent, gas supply for that year from the Cook Inlet, the amount of credits that were spent for that year. It's in the scheme of market intervention, it's a fairly overwhelming one in terms of the sheer dollar amount relative to the market. Now, obviously a lot of those credits go to many things other than gas. A huge amount of that goes to oil, some of that goes to activities that are not sort of new development but exploration. The key reason that our analysis here is focused on gas is because overwhelmingly it seems to us that the policy rationale for the credits has always been security of gas supply to South Central Alaska. And so the slides that follow, in addition to the market analysis in terms of gas that Nikos has presented, are about looking at new gas development and ongoing gas development in the Cook Inlet. As Nikos has said, we sort of split this two or three ways. First of all, greenfield versus brownfield development. And within greenfield, the question of, in an ideal world, if it were possible to develop an optimal gas project in the Cook Inlet, meaning that there would demand, sufficient demand to actually build out a project the way you would ideally like to, what do those economics look like? How do they compare to the economics when you still have to build out a lot of that infrastructure, incur all of those costs, but because, as Nikos says, there is very constrained demand, that demand is by and large well met by the legacy production, and there's only a sort of incremental wedge as that declines in terms of new demand for the gas that the new project is creating, what that does to project economics and why that makes project economics of new development in the Cook Inlet at the moment very difficult. And finally, we talk about then the brownfield side of that equation, what drilling in, we think drilling in the mature fields looks like in terms of new brownfield ongoing gas development, and how all these things might be impacted by proposed changes in the two committee substitutes. So, Madam Chair, to move to slide 28, we start off by taking that question of a market-constrained project. So the idea here was to say, and this is based on sort of publicly available numbers that companies that have recently undertaken development in the Cook Inlet have announced in terms of total costs. It's frankly a very high cost of development. A big part of that obviously is the period of the last several years until now has been one of extraordinary cost inflation, obviously, over the last decade, and so projects undertaken over the last several years have been extremely expensive projects. There are a lot of reasons to think that these sorts of costs are at the moment very, very steadily coming down, and that new gas development in the Cook Inlet undertaken from this point forward might be substantially cheaper. But what you're seeing here is a project with very difficult economics. The charts that we're showing are analogous to the charts that we showed for North Slope new development a few days ago. So on the left-hand side, what you're seeing is in the red area sort of total production. And total production in this case from a project that, as you can see, can really only drill four wells over the period of about a decade, right? And that's because, you know, if we assume, for instance, a type curve that says, well, each well can produce somewhere between 15 and 20,000 million cubic feet, so 15 and 20 million cubic feet a day of gas, again, this is a total gas market where there's only a very small incremental wedge to supply, so maybe we can drill one well to begin with and have a very small contract, and indeed we've seen one company do exactly this recently, and hope to drill a couple of additional wells in the coming years to supply a few new contracts. But because you can never get to a substantial volume of gas, what it means is that when we look at the cash flow chart on the right hand side, you know, if you just think about the cash flow charts we've presented in the past, other cash flow charts you've seen, it's sort of immediately obvious when you look at that sort of after-tax cash flow line here that there's a lot of negative in the early years as you're building out facilities, you're building out pipelines that are all sized for a much bigger project, say 100 to 200 million cubic feet a day sort of project. That's the size of the gas resource that you have. But because you're never producing more than 18 million cubic feet a day in the first years, and maybe at most in this case 40 plus million cubic feet a day in the later years, you're never really making back the cash adequately to compensate you for the huge expenses that you incurred up front in building out those facilities. And that's why you have that huge negative cash outlay in the early years and not a huge amount of positive cash flow in the later years to compensate for that. So that's very much the world of new gas development in the Cook Inlet at the moment, and why we haven't seen a lot of it, and really only seen one project which one would look at and say a lot of expense for not a lot of revenue that's going to come in. When we look at what that looks like on a few key economic metrics under the status quo and under the proposed changes, either committee substitute for Senate Bill 130 from Resources or committee substitute for House Bill 247 from House Finance, what we have here are those three scenarios. The top row of charts is looking at the split of net present value from the project between the company, the federal government, and the state. And the bottom row of charts are looking at both government take and internal rate of return for investors. So what you can see here is that this is a project that is in many ways barely economic. To the extent that it is, it's only so because of the credits. And it's fundamentally, and again, this is purely the world of gas and purely the world of constrained gas demand that exists in the Cook Inlet at the moment. But in those scenarios, you can see value to the state, for instance, is constantly negative in purely financial terms. Value to the company is positive at higher prices, but only barely. And in some ways, it's really only the federal government through corporate income tax that is doing reasonably well out of a project like this. In terms of internal rates of return, you're struggling to get into the teens at the highest possible gas prices, and that's the case even despite sort of incredibly low government take, you know, of around 40-odd percent or so. That's the case under the existing fiscal system. So it's one that has, at least in one case, enabled such a project, but enabled it essentially through overwhelming state subsidy. Both committee substitute for Senate Bill 130 and from Resources, Senate Resources, the committee substitute from House Finance take substantial action to curtail, of course, the flow of credits into the future. In the case of the House Finance version, substantially ramping down but not eliminating the credits. In the case of the Senate Resources version, saying by 2018 credits go away, but there will also be effectively a zero tax regime in the Cook Inlet, that the Cook Inlet from that point forward would look a lot like, for instance, large parts of the federal outer continental shelf, which is to say nothing but a royalty, and in the case of both the Cook Inlet and many bits of the outer continental shelf, a relatively low one, about 12.5%. Still, so an attractive fiscal regime for many developments, the one that where a development as expensive as this with as little corresponding revenue because of constrained demand, very hard to see how something like this would go ahead. And again, that may simply mean that, as Nikos says, in the future, new developments go ahead when either there is an incremental wedge of additional demand, that the new gas projects have to wait for a number of years until there is demand built up, or they only happen when there is a fundamental step change in the nature of demand in the Cook Inlet. Slightly less challenged in the world of the House Committee substitute than the Senate Resources one. In the world of the Senate Resources one, of course, the state is relatively better protected in terms of, for any such development that did go ahead, always being value positive. But fundamentally, these are both environments in which, unless costs came down very dramatically, a project like this that is high cost but demand constrained would be very challenged to go ahead. And as Nico says, the solution may simply be for such projects to wait until there is demand in the future.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, for the Chair. Just a quick question. Take a look at both basins real fast, but in this current environment where companies are losing capital, as well as the state, and especially in the slope where there's rigs being idled, would that result in a natural decline in the demand on credits without any changes anyway? In other words, if there's no capital to meet, if there's less capital to meet the credits and rigs are being idled, there's less activity, there'd be less demand or draw on the credit concept, correct?
Senator Dunleavy, through the Chair, that's absolutely correct, yes.
Has anyone done any modeling as to how that natural event is playing out in terms of less draw on the credit or potential?
Senator Dunleavy, through the Chair, we don't sort of get into sort of actual forecasting of actual numbers on the North Slope, primarily because we don't have access to the sort of confidential plans and taxpayer data that the administration has. Certainly, I think there are a few pieces to that. One question is, in terms of what's currently in the forecast, are there pieces that one might think will actually fall off, both in terms of spending and in terms of future production because of the low price environment? And certainly my intuition would be yes, I would expect that. The second part is to say, more broadly, for instance, even when we look at the questions of forgetting new development, simply ongoing maintenance capital spending and brownfield development within the mature projects on the North Slope, for instance, there's been some question of concern over, you know, the possibility of, if one had a low price environment going forward for several years, could we have sort of major companies running a net operating loss for multiple years? There is some possibility for that, but it seems to me, again, that is substantially constrained, more than the numbers I think that have been presented show, by the fact that, frankly, in that scenario, one of three things has to change. Either the price is going to recover at some point, or if it doesn't, companies are going to find a way to very dramatically reduce costs, both, first of all, by not undertaking a lot of ongoing drilling, a lot of that capital that has an impact on production decline, of course, and finding ways for reducing operating costs, right? And if it's not possible to do all those three to a point that you get back to being cash flow positive, then in lots of ways, the implications of that are a lot scarier than just trailing net operating loss credits, because no company in the world maintains a cash-losing asset for multiple years.
Just one last follow-up. Looking at Cook Inlet and following up on what Senator Machicki had asked earlier, it's $6 an MCF and a lower 40 awash in oil, but also a similar situation in terms of capital in those companies. The constrained environment that you described really is not, one could see that as not really being attractive for a capital-constrained company to move a rig up here, move activity up here in a very small market, correct?
Senator Dunleavy, that is correct. Both in terms, you know, we're really talking about a world of relatively smaller companies that are interested in the size of the opportunity here, given part of the resource base, but in particular the size of the market.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Mayor, our brief at ease. Record, we have about 10 more minutes.
Madam Chair, I'll get through the remaining slides quickly. So the second set of project analyses looks at exactly the same spending profile in terms of amount spent up front on facilities, capex, on pipelines, all the rest, but says if there weren't this market constraint, what would this look like? To understand how much is it the market constraint that ultimately makes development so difficult. And so this assumes that instead of drilling just those sort of four wells spaced out over a course of many years, that instead one can drill, you know, three wells a year for the first 3 years, several a well pretty much every year for a period after that, and maintain a sort of production plateau at around 130, 140 million cubic feet a day of gas. And, you know, when you look at the cash flow chart that results from that, it looks a lot more like what one is expecting. This looks like a much healthier development. And when we go to slide 31, that's exactly what we see. This is a world in which a project like this is no longer being sort of out and out subsidized by the state in terms of the value of the credits versus the value of the revenues that occur through the royalties for a project like this, where the state is net present value positive for the project, although the share of value between the company and the state is certainly vastly in favor of the company in that sense, and where, you know, particularly given the credits, you have attractive internal rates of return in the status quo. But even when you look at the two committee substitutes, either no credits or substantially reduced credits, you could see how it's possible for a project like this to go ahead regardless. Finally, Madam Chair, to look at the third example, which is to take the same sort of drilling schedule of just a few wells over a course of multiple years, slightly lower productivity to those wells because we're talking about additional drilling in mature fields rather than wells in a completely greenfield development, but without any of the upfront capital cost of facilities and pipelines. And so this is, yeah, we think, a good proxy in that sense for looking at the question of economics of ongoing drilling for gas in mature fields. When we get to the results there, the bottom line here is to say that, in our view, it's hard to see that this is not attractive and economic work across a pretty broad range of prices and potential fiscal scenarios. That even without credits, this is work that is substantially value positive to the company. Value positive in all of these scenarios for the state as well, but obviously far more so, and the state is far better protected in the lower or no credit scenarios. But one in which, you know, rates of return, for instance, look healthy even in a no credit or a lower credit scenario. So I think to wrap up that discussion and think about what conclusions one might draw from that, broadly speaking, and we've said this a number of times in the course of testimony here, clearly the overall credit situation in the Cook Inlet isn't sustainable. Most importantly, there are ongoing developments occurring at the moment with capital contracted for 2016, and that any changes in 2016 have potentially very profound impacts which have not very thoroughly thought through, you know, could even result in the bankruptcy of some of those companies undertaking that work. So protecting companies currently undertaking development in 2016, I think, is the first thing that one thinks is most critical. After that, clearly it's possible to substantially reduce support going forward over the next several years. If one does that, our analysis at least is that when it comes to the security of gas supply for South Central Alaska, that provided a sufficient degree of broader fiscal certainty, that it remains attractive to do ongoing brownfield drilling in the mature fields. And I say that with a crucial caveat, provided fiscal security and certainty. That is to say, one can make a substantial change, one can substantially withdraw credits, but for these economics to be attractive, companies have to genuinely believe that these are the economics, that they don't have to sort of penalize their assessment of what's coming because they're not sure that beyond the next year or two, whatever the fiscal system that has been announced is still going to be in place. And so there are a number of processes through which that certainty can be achieved. That can be the approach taken by Senate Resources to say withdrawing all credits, but also having essentially a zero tax environment in the Cook Inlet, something that looks like the outer continental shelf moving forward. The alternative is to say, no, there'll be some different regime moving forward that may combine a smaller amount of credits and some form of production tax. And probably we need more time than we have this session to create that, and so there might be a working group to put that together between now and the next regular session, but there is a defined period of time with which we will develop that, and from this time next year forward, companies will know what the future of this looks like. Whichever approach one takes, it's important that sooner rather than later, there is certainty as to what this regime looks like if one wants to see ongoing development of the brownfield assets in the Cook Inlet. When it comes to new gas development on the greenfield front, when there is sufficient demand, we think that can occur, and that overwhelmingly the biggest barrier to that is demand more than anything else, and that the big thing that taking away credits does there is it takes away the ability to do what's been done in at least one case, which is a major capital project when there's only limited demand available for that project to meet.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Senator Machicki, did you have a question?
Well, I do a quick one, and I can use just a couple word answer. Just back on slide 31. So this demonstrates that the elimination of an income tax or a production tax on gas in Cook Inlet between CS Senate Bill 130 and CSHB 247 has virtually no effect. The only difference in the reduction of the internal rate of return and the increase in the revenue to the state is just simply the level of the reduction of credits between the two bills. Is that correct?
Senator Machicki, broadly that's correct. There is a small effect of eliminating the tax, but because it's a very small tax, it's a minimal effect.
Thank you. I've got lots of questions, so we'll get together. I have more questions about greenfield and drilling existing field differences as well.
So the purpose of the last few days was to set a realistic foundation for understanding how the state is affected on its revenue stream, how companies are affected, and the history of two different markets that have been incentivized with credits in Alaska, in both North Slope, mostly the North Slope and Cook Inlet. We do have Middle Earth in there, but there's not a lot of activity in Middle Earth. Mr. Mayor, any closing comments for consideration? Again, I've asked committee members to make appointments with you, preferably tomorrow, so that we have that foundation solidified before we start looking at a path forward. Any other questions? Mr. Mayor.
Madam Chair, I think to close, I'd simply come back to the sort of overall conceptualization that I've mentioned a few times here, which is to say, when we think about the scope of this problem, clearly a big difference between the situation in the Cook Inlet versus the North Slope. The credits in the Cook Inlet have always been about things that the state did to incentivize activities that look a lot less affordable at the moment than they have been in the past. Then on the North Slope, credits remaining other than there are those that shape the tax rate and are really a math exercise, that there's the net operating loss credit, and that's really about timing of cash flows far more than it's about the total amount, unless one makes very major changes to that system. And yeah, I think my closing remarks are simply to sort of reiterate that as a framework for approaching the problem, I guess.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy.
Just a quick question. The Cook Inlet basin that we're looking at is mainly gas, but you touched over and you kind of went through pretty quickly the fact that there's been an increase in oil production. Is that all promise that we can continue to increase oil production? I'm not saying necessarily return to historic levels of decades ago, but is that a real possibility?
Senator, let me through the chair. Nikos, do you have additional comments to make on that? Certainly, I would say that there is scope for substantial ongoing activity. A lot of that, I would say, depends far more than anything else on the oil price rather than on the credit environment.
Right, and the only reason I brought that up is your transportation costs, production costs are going to be a little lower in Cook Inlet, and at one time I think it was 250,000 barrels a day, which the value to that in Cook Inlet as opposed to further north, there's still value in that for the state of Alaska, and I just was wondering
if there's promise in that. But we'll ask you that question tomorrow in more detail.
Senator Labor, through the chair, you're correct in particular that I think the value of Cook Oil is frequently not adequately stated in that sense, which is, you know, North Slope Oil has all of the huge transportation costs of getting it through the pipe and then getting it shipped down to the West Coast market. Cook Inlet has none of those transportation costs, a very small one to get it to local refineries, and it's also light, high-quality oil. It's a point that I think is important to make, absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, would the credit market in general see Alaska in a more stable environment if we were using the resources that we have that are in the bank to either have a fixed draw or an annuity payment that helped with our revenue stream?
Madam Chair, if the question is about the sort of broader fiscal model under which the state itself operates, certainly I think we would say there can be no question that for resource states around the world, it is a best practice to have substantial assets and to use those assets to smooth the volatility that comes from being dependent on commodity prices. Well-run petrostates have some major source of assets, some sort of sovereign wealth fund usually, and they live off the earnings of that fund and put the revenues that come from the resource back into that fund to maintain and grow it rather than trying to live off the resource itself directly.
And so for an industry that has located in Alaska, that would be a positive step and a step towards stability for both their taxing structure and industry and investments versus the current structure where we have feast and famine dependent on price. Would that be fair?
Madam Chair, I think that's absolutely fair, and it's particularly the case when you think about some of the points we started with about sort of net versus gross taxes, right? That Alaska has this net tax on the North Slope in particular that is there because it's more efficient, less distorting of investment, and takes more for the state in the long run across the economic cycle, but inherently it's more volatile. And places, by and large, that take a net tax approach are either diversified economies that are not as exposed to that volatility, or, you know, for instance, like Norway, find some other way to compensate for that volatility, i.e. living off the fund, not the revenues directly.
Thank you. With that, it is 4:30. I'd like to take a brief at ease while we change out presentations. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Welcome back to Senate Finance. We do have other items on the agenda. The next item on the agenda is SB 128. Your documents, you have a CS in front of you, and under the CS is all the documents that we're going to talk about. When we adopt the CS, those of you at home should have four pieces of documents. You'll have a CS, you'll have a new sectional analysis on SB 128, you'll have a cash flow under SB 128 and under HB 245, and you'll have something called document B that has bar charts and graphs that are four indicators on how we are looking at the health of what we're doing. Senator Machicki, do you have a motion to adopt the CS?
I do, Madam Chair. I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 128 Finance 29-GS2859/S before the committee as a working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion. Ms. Kramer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Laura Kramer. I'm staff to the Senate Finance Committee and Senator McKinnon. This is a new CS before you that we rolled out from last week, I guess it was now. And I'll just go through the changes that are in the bill. It's still the 5.25% POMV with the 20% coming from the POMV for the dividend, 20% from royalties for the dividend. The first change is in Section 2. This is language requiring the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation to adopt regulations similar to the state's procurement code. What we're doing here is we're exempting the Permanent Fund Corporation from the state procurement code, and that is in Section 3, exempting them from the state's procurement code. Section 5 is the next change. This transfers the management of the Constitutional Budget Reserve from the Department of Revenue to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. The next change is Section 6. This requires the Permanent Fund Corporation to prepare an annual report on the balance and returns of the CBR. This is just like the currently is done by the Department of Revenue, but with the transfer to the Permanent Fund, it would require them to provide the same report. The next change can be found in Section 9. B stayed the same. This is the 5.25%. C is the reserves, 20% of the POMV payout for dividends. The remaining 80% of the payout is subject to dollar-for-dollar reduction as oil and gas revenue rises above $1.2 billion adjusted for inflation. So this is a cap, some would call it, a $1.2 billion cap. Subsection 1 is also new. Oil and gas unrestricted general fund revenue, excluding the amount to be paid as 20% of the prior year royalties to the dividend. And number 2 sets out the revenue limit, the cap that I just spoke of $1.2 billion. Section 10, E, added to the end of this section, each year the legislature may appropriate to the general fund the amount available for distribution from the earnings reserve account under the POMV found in Section 10B. And what's added is, and the limit calculation, which I just discussed, found in Section 10C.
That should, Senator Hoster. Should be
9. Thank you, Madam Chair. When you looked at Section 9, paragraph 2, you said $1.2 billion. That looks like $1.2 million to me.
It is. In the bill, it's correct. It's $1.2 billion is the limit. And then F, subsection F of Section 10, that is the inflation proofing mechanism. The next change is Section 12. This is conforming language relating to procurement for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And then the next change is in Section 18. This is the repeal language section. Added to this was repealing the sub-account of the Constitutional Budget Reserve. Remaining in that section is the former dividend calculation, the inflation-proofing calculation, and the Amrita Hess language With that, Madam Chair, that's the changes. David Teal is here to walk the committee through the mechanics of the changes.
Is there any further questions on adoption of the CS? Seeing and hearing none, I remove my objection. Any further objections? Seeing and hearing none, the CS for Senate Bill Number 128, Finance, /S, is before the committee. Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. Document A is, I guess you could call it another sectional analysis, but it's got some numbers attached to it. So it's a briefer sections, only those with the cash flow associated. Section 7 reduces royalties dedicated to the permanent fund from the new fields, which is post-1980. They're now dedicating 50% to the permanent fund principal. That will be reduced to the constitutional minimum of 25%, and the cash impact of that is revenue to the general fund will increase by about $50 million annually. Section 8 deleted the old income, the definition of income available for distribution, and that was, of course, based on earnings rather than on balances of the earnings reserve account. Section 9 replaces that earnings-based available for distribution formula with a percent of market value payout, normally referred to as POMV calculation, and the nominal payout is 5.25%. The effective payout will be about 4.8% in the long run, assuming that the permanent fund earns its target return of 5% and inflation is 2.25%. That realized or effective payout is lower than the nominal 5% payout because of the lag, and the table below explains how that works. You'll see that for fiscal year 17, you would be using the average balance in the first five of the preceding 6 years, is what the law says. And that average balance is the boxed balances in the table. So you can see that the average balance here is 45.8, which is roughly equivalent to a three-year-old balance of the fund. So the next column with the 5.2% payout based on the average balance is $2.4 billion. But if you divide that $2.4 billion into the FY16 balance, which is the more current balance, the payout is only 4.6%. As it moves along and smooths out and the balance becomes a steadier trend, that payout goes up to about 4.8%. So Section C then ensures that 20% of the payout goes to dividends. The reason for that separation is we want to be sure that dividends are not reduced with the limit that's going to be imposed on the payout. And if the earnings assumptions come true, that 20% going to dividends will be in the $500 to $600 million range annually. The GF portion, or the portion that goes to the general fund, the remaining 80% of that payout, is subject to the dollar-for-dollar reduction as oil prices rise above $1.2 billion, and that $1.2 billion will be adjusted for inflation. So the limit, I guess I should call it a revenue limit, kicks in at about $75 oil. And there are two charts on the next page that allow you to compare that. And you'll notice that the charts are identical up to about $70. Both show at $70 oil revenue of about $4 billion. Beyond that point, you're going to have more than $1 billion worth of the blue bars, and I should explain the bars. The red at the bottom is non-volatile revenue. It will not be subject to the limit.
The non-volatile revenue includes corporate income tax, various fees, alcohol taxes, tobacco taxes, etc. would include an income tax. Anything except the more volatile stream of revenue that comes from production taxes and royalties on oil. The green bar is the POMV, and on the unlimited payout, that would be about $2 billion, no matter what the price of oil is. And on the chart to the right, you see what happens with the limit in effect. And again, the charts are identical through $70, but at above $70, you're beginning to produce more than $1.2 billion in volatile revenue. And you, at that point, it's a dollar-for-dollar reduction in the POMV payout. You keep your volatile revenue stream, but reduce your POMV. So revenue then stays flat at $4.1 billion because for every dollar in revenue you get, you're reducing your payout by a dollar. And then at about $100 oil, you've reduced your POMV payout to zero. At that point, the volatile revenue turns back up. But at any point on this chart, after the after you've reached $100, the revenue is limited by about $2 billion. So it is a spending limit, revenue limit, however you want to phrase it. In Section 10, it allows an appropriation from the Earnings Reserve Account, most commonly referred to as the ERA. That's where permanent funding earnings accumulate. And that there's an appropriation allowed to the general fund. That's the appropriation that can be reduced by the revenue limit. The portion that goes to dividends will not be reversed by the limit. Section F outlines inflation-proofing methodology, and what that says is whenever the ERA balance is four times the amount of the payout, which this is really the governor's proposal, if that's comfortable enough to ensure that the payout in the near future won't be in danger, then you can begin putting the excess into the permanent fund principle. Section 11 just provides for dividends. They are the sum of the 20% of the POMV payout plus 20% of the royalties that go into the general fund.
Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this page, going up to number 3 up the top where it says when oil prices are above 100, I just need you to clarify for us, Mr. Thiel. When you look at those charts, this is a revenue, it's not a spending limit, it's a revenue limit that we're talking about. And it's a revenue limit that just focuses on the permanent fund. It doesn't focus on potential taxes. Your red line below are the non-volatile revenues, correct? Your red bars?
Through the chair, that's correct.
And there's nothing in the bill that would prevent the legislature from increasing taxes and thus growing that red bar, series of red bars in the bottom, correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
And as those red bars grow, the spending limit, again, is just focused on the permanent fund. So, in fact, excuse me, the revenue limit, because it's not a spending limit. The revenue limit, once again, is just focused on the permanent fund concept of the non-volatile revenue, the volatile revenue, making it non-volatile, in a way. We can continue to spend more money by raising taxes.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Machicki.
Mr. Thiel, I'm going to go back a little bit, if I may, Madam Chair. In the sheet that was reviewed earlier, can you explain the importance of the changes to Section 5 and Section 6?
Through the chair.
We actually have Angela Rodell from the Permanent Fund Corporation talk about those. Certainly want to hear from Mr. Teal. Mr. Teal, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, if I can just preface that statement that we understand the value and the difference of the earnings, but the general public has very little knowledge about why that's an important piece of this bill.
And Madam Chair, if Ms. Rodell is here, she might just address it rather than me, because I think it's going to be a similar answer, and she's more affected by this change than I am.
Thank you, Mr. Teal. Mr. Teal, if you could finish on your chart.
I am. That is the end of the cash flow explanation.
Okay, I have a chart question.
Mr. Teal, when you were back on page one, you said something about capping the dividend. Do we cap the dividend in this piece of legislation, or do we guarantee the dividend for 3 years at $1,000 and then tie it directly with the volatility of oil and the opportunity of the interest earnings?
The latter. Actually, the calculations show a pretty constant dividend near $1,000. And it's far less volatile dividend than we see today, where dividends have bounced in recent years from less than $1,000 to over $2,000. Because dividends will be based on the balance of the permanent fund, they're going to be much steadier and about $1,000, but the bill does guarantee a dividend for 3 years of $1,000, at which time the formula takes over and should continue dividends near there, but not guaranteed. They might be higher than that. They might be slightly lower.
That's accurate, Mr. Teal. And these projections that are modeled include our spring forecast. Is that accurate?
Yes, ma'am. Spring forecast.
Do you recall what the highest price per barrel of oil that's modeled in that is at, that is being fed into this for future years?
Not right offhand, but I think it's close to $60, and that's at the end of the forecast period.
Thank you, Mr. Teal. That's where I wanted to get Alaska's base on. Alaska's experience as high as $140, $150 a barrel oil. We're currently probably below $40 a barrel right now, and averaging just right at 40 for the year or something close to that. And this projection is on 60 out in future years, not up front and close, and we certainly can have Department of Revenue talk about that. Senator Mushiki, you had a question on the graph.
I do, and back to the graph on the right with the payout limit. You actually only have a revenue limit to about $100 a barrel. And I down in Section 10, you explain that if the ERA balance is comfortably high, defined as 4 times the maximum allowable payout, then the excess balance may be appropriated to the permanent fund principal. Is that something, Mr. Teal, that you think you would like to see in statute? Or do you find that something that legislators have a tendency to ignore? I certainly would feel more comfortable knowing that we actually had a revenue limit as opposed to having a revenue limit only to $100 a barrel.
Through the chair, first, it may look like revenue is limited only to $100, but if you look at the chart at, for instance, $130 oil, the limited revenue there is just under 7. Well, the unlimited revenue would have been just under 9. So beyond $100 oil, there is a $2 billion revenue limit at every price. What you're looking at is the phase-in goes from $75 to $100, at which time revenue is being limited by something less than $2 billion. So I guess, not to argue, but the revenue is limited at everything beyond every price beyond 75, and that would be about a $2 billion effect. Now, the second part of your question, I guess, could you repeat?
Right. So when we talk about the ERA balance being comfortably high, and you're defining that as four times the maximum allowable payout, that's kind of a danger zone, right? There's no requirement in this bill for a transfer, so that becomes available for appropriation. And that would be a difficult thing to limit, particularly if we have a large amount of deferred maintenance, haven't seen capital in, of, you know, any substantive capital in many years. That becomes a dangerous amount of revenue available with no real controls in this bill.
Through the chair, it's certainly true that the transfer, the inflation-proofing transfer, would be subject to appropriation. But as you well know, the entire earnings reserve account is subject to appropriation. So regardless of the revenue limit, regardless of the balance, whether it's four times or less than four times, the legislature can appropriate it not just to the corpus of the permanent fund, but for any purpose. And all you're doing with these statutes is setting, whether you want to call them rules or guidelines, it doesn't really matter. They're setting out a course of action that everyone hopes the legislature will follow in the future. But you cannot bind future legislatures. You cannot restrict their ability to spend the earnings reserve account. And so if you're asking my opinion about whether this is an effective limit or whether inflation proofing will occur, I guess I can only point to the legislature's following the rules regarding spending from the earnings reserve in the past, which rules have been followed.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Senator Zunley, did you have a question?
Just a quick question, David. It's not meant to be a trick question, but what's our production going to be next year?
Through the chair, I don't know.
What's our price of oil going to be in a year from now?
I don't know that either.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Zunley, which is why we're trying to flatten out the draw and provide a revenue stream different than the volatility of oil, and why we have a CS before you so that you can have considerations on whatever particular items you believe are appropriate to look at in this piece of legislation. Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to take Senator Dunleavy's question one step further. What's it look like in 2030? And that's what we should be looking towards as a body.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, Mr. Till, how long have you been with the legislature in this capacity?
Through the chair, roughly 20 years.
Has it been your experience that we're able to control our spending?
Through the chair.
It's an opinion. From experience.
I believe it is controlled, because otherwise you wouldn't have had $15 billion in savings that are the one and only reason you're able to survive the crisis this long. So well, people may argue that the legislature spent more than it should have. They saved an awful lot of money.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Teal. Thank you, Ms. Kramer. If I could invite the administration, Department of Law and Department of Revenue, General Richards, Commissioner Hoffbeck. We have a CS. I believe we've had a conversation with you on the CS. General Richards, comments on the CS?
For the record, Craig Richards, Attorney General. And thank you, Madam Chair. By and large, the administration is very supportive of the CS. It's a good bill. It's a good bill in the sense that technically it operates soundly, and it's a good bill in the sense from the administration's perspective that it accomplishes most of what we sought out to accomplish in the permanent fund restructuring, which includes drawing from the permanent fund in a sustainable manner to provide for government, but controlling the volatility in such a way that we don't grow a big government on permanent fund earnings when in fact oil prices rise again. So we think it's a good compromise, and that includes the percentage of market value approach for the draw is very reasonable. I have testified in House Finance that, you know, 5.25% is pretty aggressive. It's sort of the limit of aggressiveness under the Department of Revenue's modeling. It does meet our sustainable definition, so it does get there, but it's right on the line. A more conservative approach, if the committee wanted to, might be to take that 5.25% back to 5 and give you a little buffer room. But that's, you know, a policy decision for the committee in the House. And then the other parts of the bill that we're pleased with are the inflation-proofing mechanism. We do think it's important that we grow the corpus over time and not be in a situation where, you know, the corpus shrinks and the earnings reserve increases and we sort of degrade the protected portion, you know, to benefit the earnings reserve. This is a good balance. In terms of the revenue limit itself, we think it works. There's some technical issues that need to be worked out, just really around whether the language does exactly what everybody has kind of come to consensus on. But we're going to work that out, hopefully, in, you know, in a very short period of time. So with that, Madam Chairman, I think those were my comments. Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Redman, and I concur with the statements that the Attorney General made. We're pleased with the product that has been produced. We'd like to say we've got a little bit on the language just to make sure it's doing exactly what everybody expects it to do, but it's a good bill. And I did want to address Senator Machicki's question on Section 5 and 6, just real briefly. Director Rodell and I have discussed this. We recognize the direction that this bill takes, the CBR. First it hit my pride a little bit, but then as I looked at it, I thought, you know, because of the way we're starting to use all of these funds together to fund government, there is some logic to having a little bit more of the consistency in the investment. The two things to consider, one is that I don't want to caution the committee and the legislature not to put too much expectation on the permanent fund. They will be able to invest it in relationship to the other funds, but there is a large amount of money that needs to be kept liquid, and to expect a 6% return, I think, would be putting in a pretty big burden on the permanent fund on the CBR. So just if everybody keeps the realization what's actually achievable by the permanent fund. The second one is that there will be one that we'll need to actually have a small appropriation, not this year, but next year if the permanent fund is managing the CBR. Because unlike other investment funds where we net fees against the fund, we can't net the fees against the CBR because that would be drawing money out of the CBR. And so we've always funded the management fees for the CBR with general fund money. And so we'll have to deal with that. It's not going to be a large some of money, but it's going to be something that comes up next year's budget that's going to look a little bit awkward because we're going to have to be doing some provision to RSA money to the Permanent Fund Corporation or direct general fund appropriation in order to manage this particular fund. But everything's doable, it's workable, and we can make it work.
We have multiple questions. Senator Hoffman, followed by Senator Bishop.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the administration probably looking at this favorably, but the problem that I have, and we've discussed this, you and I, Madam Chairman, is the level of comfort legislators have when we're dealing with what will be the permanent fund dividend level. And I understand that we need to utilize this fund and am willing to go as far as guaranteeing the people $1,000 for 3 years, but to put that into statute permanently with this formula, which I have a little bit concern about. I would put in a different formula, probably a formula that would be described as maybe guaranteeing the $1,000, and then every fourth or fifth year adjust the dividend for inflation over that course of those 4 or 5 years, so that people would, and it's sort of you know, coming from the standpoint that it is the people's money, and the administration came up with a plan to have a guaranteed output for government, and this takes a different look at it and maybe have a guaranteed outlook, not at a high level, but a guaranteed outlook for dividends of the people's money. So those are just comments that I have, and I think we need to be a little bit cautious when we put in, change the formula so drastically all of a sudden, and then it's there until the legislature decides to change it.
Senator Hoffman, I'd say that there's a 3-year review period to look at some of those specific issues that you raised. Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Dunleavy.
Just briefly, I just wanted to dovetail on Senator Hoffman's comments. I was had the same concerns on the inflation proofing of the check and having to look back after 4 years. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, some of us are concerned that if the plan is adopted, the downward pressure on the budget will cease. In other words, the heavy lifting, the difficult decisions that have to be made on reductions in the budget will end, basically. And then, as was mentioned, the revenue limit and the plan itself deals with the permanent fund, but there's nothing that says there won't be any taxes or income taxes or sales taxes to keep up with, I think most people would say over time will be increased spending. In order for some of us that are, you know, looking at this plan, what can you tell us, and what can you tell the public that the administration is going to do to continue to ramp down spending? In other words, and I don't mean theoretically, but for example, this budget coming forward, should the public be looking at any a number of vetoes on certain expenditures in order to get this budget down into the mid to low $4 billion range? What can we look forward to? Because I think that is part of the mix, and although we're talking about the permanent fund and potential mechanics, changing the mechanics, people are wondering how we're going to control our spending, because if it's just to access one additional revenue stream in which taxes can also be accessed, you may lose some support for this. So if you can just help me with that, please.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, I can't speak to what may or may not be vetoed by the governor, but there's still, up until you get up to about $70 oil price, we don't bump up against the limitation within this particular plan. So there's always going to be some downward pressure to fill that gap, and that's either with additional spending reductions or with new revenues. And certainly the governor has a revenue package that's still in play to fill part or all of that gap. So, as long as we're below $70 oil price, this particular model doesn't do anything to reduce that downward pressure and that need to balance the budget.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. I would point committee members and those that are following us at home, on document B, there are 4 health checks that we are doing on the fiscal model. In the upper left-hand corner of the document, we look at spending that is specifically pointed out by Senator Dunleavy. How do you maintain a downward pressure? And so on that particular chart, it shows where the money would be withdrawn from based on our spring forecast. And if you go right below it, it looks at our budget reserve and the health of our savings accounts as another checkpoint to see how this particular model is functioning. And then up in the upper right-hand corner, we look at dividends to Alaskans, and this is what Senator Hoffman is saying, that should we maintain a flat dividend, there's erosion of those dollars over time, and how do we have an opportunity for Alaskans to share more in the wealth of Alaska, which is why I was saying that This model works under the current price forecast, which is very down, and Alaska has seen very much different volatility all the way from 20 in the 25 dollar range in our recent history up to the $140-$150 range. And so if we plugged in higher models, if you would plugged in higher values for the oil coming through that's predicted right now, at least estimated by the department at about 5,000 barrels a day for the next couple years, and then it starts sliding down again. Certainly we're not seeing the investment that we want with the prices that we have. And there in the very bottom right-hand corner is the health of the permanent fund and the corpus itself and how the corpus will grow over time. Again, back to the budget reserves, under this scenario, there are 36 years in play before the budget reserves would be extinguished. And the value of the permanent fund's corpus itself grows, though we need to watch, as General Richards said, at a 5.25 draw, it may fare a little bit less well than at a 5% draw. But what I wanted to point out specifically is the taxing issue that Senator Dunleavy has raised, and which is a concern, I believe, to everyone sitting at this table. This particular scenario shows a target cut for this year of $250 million, $247 is on your analysis. It shows community assistance that we did have a way to pay for a huge portion of that, but the other body chose to pick a different scenario, so I believe that is dead. A capital budget of $185 million, which should, as Senator Bishop and Senator Machicki said, should do something, but will create a backlog of deferred maintenance. But if you go down to the tax section, revenue variables, in the model that's before you, Senate Finance Committee members, there is only the Senate Resources Tax Credit Reform here. And so there are no other taxes on this proposal. And Commissioner, does this proposal draw or provide revenue diversity of about $2.4 billion? So my point is we've still got a hole.
I'm sure that is correct.
Okay. And so I just wanted to put that out there as we hit home what constituents are calling us, emailing us about, that they are not interested in a sales tax, an income tax, or a variety of proposals. And there are other groups of Alaskans who are absolutely saying that they are willing and would like to pay what they consider their fair share. So we have Alaskans across the board on this issue. But I just wanted to point out those things that Senator Dunleavy, in this model, the budget hole is not filled, and that tax credit reform is, or at least the number for tax credit reform, is what the calculation includes. Senator Hoffman?
One other point. Not only is the gap not completely filled, from my viewpoint, the capital budget is fixed at $185 million, which is over the course of a decade or even longer, is unrealistic.
Senator Hoffman, if I could point you to document A that's online in page 2, and when we look at the undesignated general fund revenue with the payout limit, you do see additional dollars available that could be diverted to the CBR, could be diverted to a capital account so that we can do deferred maintenance. It could be diverted to reduction in the unfunded liability sitting over in our retirement system. So we absolutely have a lot of things that need to be happening to make our state place our state in a better position fiscally. So there are opportunities to look at those things, and General Richards and I, as well as Commissioner Hoffback, have talked about those options. But the scenarios before you provide as much flexibility to close over 50% of Alaska's current budget deficit, which should be seen favorably in the financial circles and on the consumer market. Senator Michicki, followed by Senator Hoffman, followed by Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Hoffbeck, you started with the pride thing. In this business, we'll make sure we shake any remaining out of you in the next couple of years. But couple of questions. I mean, sovereign wealth, some people don't like that term, but we are a sovereign that has essentially made a living off of the sale of oil on the global market. Managed well in just a few years with normal corpus growth, we could be actually fully sustainable without taxing Alaskans if we're responsible and price of oil has some sort of recovery. When I talk about the spending limit, how would you envision, and I don't believe in giving up our appropriation authority to the administration, I just don't. I don't think that's we have a clear responsibility in our branches of government for appropriation. But how would you see getting there sooner, being fully self-sustainable, where my grandchildren are in a state even with normal escalation, that we would have a fully sustainable budget?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki. I would like to say that I think we can grow our way to a sustainable budget without additional revenues, but I just don't think that is possible, short of a large rebound in price in the very short term. And one of the concerns we have, I think, is that there's at least some sense that this is a short-term problem that we're facing. But I think we may have very much a structural change in oil price because of the technology changes that really allow a tremendous amount of oil to be brought online in the $60 to $70 price point. And at a $60 to $70 price point, there's not enough money in the oil and gas side of the equation plus the permanent fund to get us to a sustainable budget. We'll need some other forms of revenue as well.
Senator Michicki.
I think I talked about children and grandchildren, so we're talking about the long term, not the short term. We've got a balance. Well, we would have a draw today, effective payout of 4.62% of $2.4 billion. That's going to grow and increase even with this formula through the years. So I'm talking about the long term. And again, the question was based on $105 plus if we get in that position. If we don't, it's an adjustment that we would have to look at very differently. So my question is, what was your vision of what happens when revenue exceeds responsible spending?
Senator, through the chair. So, I mean, the fundamental difference between this revenue limit and what was the original drafting of the Permanent Fund Protection Act is the Permanent Fund Protection cap would have sliced off the spikes. When you got to your, $105 oil, it would have maintained that flat line. So the difference between the vision as articulated in this revenue limit and the one in the original bill was the original bill would have maintained that flat spending level from those three cash flows across all price ranges, whereas this one allows for not spending permanent fund revenues when oil prices are higher, and you do have additional revenues in a high oil price environment to go towards, as the Senator said, the CBR or to capital programs or whatever you choose to spend it on.
Madam Chair.
And I hope that addressed your question.
What's your time limit like, Madam Chair?
We're not pushed. We have a floor session that is technical in nature today, so we do have one more presenter to come before us and three people in line for questions. Senator Michicki.
So your plan had an automatic deposit into the corpus, and I think that concerns some folks. So that's why I'm asking that question. Is there another mechanism that would be largely statutory where the legislature felt like it didn't relent on that control? So I'm thinking of some sort of a compromise where it might be a statutory limit that has a formal gate that you would have to evaluate whether or not it was time to deposit into the corpus. And I sent a note to Mr. Teal over here. I was just looking for something where the legislature would have a very public
discussion if they wanted to break those rules.
Senator Richie, through the chair, so I think that the language, obviously when it comes to inflation proofing, the way it's drafted now is it's the legislature may inflation proof. I believe that's pretty similar to the language that's on the books now for inflation proofing under the current system. So, you know, in those eras when you have inflation proofing, it's at least been the construct, as I understand it, that there's been an appropriation that occurs every year, and the bill doesn't propose changing that.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
I pass. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As you look at the thing that's most important, or what people think about that are walking the streets, the common person out there, is the dividend calculation, which is somewhat different than the Permanent Fund Protection Act. And in this particular area, I guess I'm wondering what your comfort level is with its calculation when you start looking at a fairly stable dividend out there, somewhere around $1,000 plus or minus a few, but as opposed to one that is more riding the market, or maybe a few joints away, but it's essentially riding the market as was proposed under the governor's plan.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, in the governor's plan, it rode the market. It gave us a little bit more of a dividend reflecting the income that we had available. I think we heard a lot of comments about the fact that that was more than the public was willing to accept, and the $1,000 number became kind of a number that started being used. And so this, the formula that was developed here keeps the dividend in that $1,000 range, which I think is kind of where the public acceptance range really is. The issue, of course, with that is that the higher the dividend, they have to make up the revenues someplace, and the pie is only so big. And so that means, do you cut something else, or do you raise additional revenue in some other fashion in order to support the dividends a little higher than what the governor had in his original plan?
Last question, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
In the back of our mind as policymakers, there's always the issue of the bond rating that has been negatively affected recently because of what's gone on in the state of Alaska. Under this plan versus the plan that the governor put forward, what would you see as the effect on that rating, and in how short a period of time? Which one would be more positive in the near future as opposed to longer future?
So, Chair Senator Olson, I think that either of these two plans to use the permanent fund earnings will be received, I think, in a relatively similar fashion. I think it was important for the bond rating agencies to see that this is an available source of revenue to secure bonds, and I think that's important. But the other portion is how fast and how how close do we get, and how fast do we get there in closing the rest of the deficit, so that we don't have a continual drawdown on our savings? Because one of the things that allowed the state of Alaska to carry a little bit higher bond rating than it normally would under the metrics was because of the size of the savings that we had. And so, as that draws down, if we draw that down hard, that could still have an impact. But the biggest piece was that we heard from them was the permanent fund earnings. The second was, and using that to create a situation where we don't draw down our savings as quickly.
So, further questions, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Senator Olson. I just wanted to thank both of you. I know that my staff has said it's been a pleasure to work with you and your team in trying to model our ideas to make sure that they were tested against what the governor had originally proposed. In a difference of opinion in whether the annuity style would benefit us better, that has been discussed here today, versus more of an endowment approach style. So we appreciate those working efforts, as well as everything that you've done to help get us to this particular point. Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the question of reserve liquidity, you touched on that a little bit earlier. Is there something that we could do to help with sort of a quarterly or monthly or periodic draw that would help with the liquidity equation, or are things set up in statute today that you think optimizes that?
Senator
ability for a better return.
So, Chair, so I'm checking. One of them, I think the provision was in this bill to remove that the section C of the one that had the 5-year requirement. I don't know if it's remained in the CS or not. It was in the prior version. That allows us to use a little bit more of a prudent investor role for investing in the CBR. So I think that's big. The fact that the CBR will not be the primary source of filling the gap, we'll be using the earnings reserve, and then slowing that rate of draw will allow it to be invested more aggressively. As far as the quarterly, monthly, annual draw, I think that's something that internally we only draw as needed. We don't draw it all out. We only take the money in cash when we hit a level that we need to make an additional draw. But we have to have liquid the funds for the year that it's been appropriated from. And so we can put in 2 months, 3 months, 6 month investments to account for when we need the draw, but none of us are making much money at this period of time. So it really is that piece that doesn't need to be used in the current year that I think is where our benefit can be, and that really is the sustainable plan. We know how it's going to be used going in the future.
General Richards, did you have a comment? General Richards, how do you respond in setting a spending limit? We've had minimal conversations about a spending limit. Alaska's Constitution talks about a spending limit, and there's always been this balance between a spending limit and not binding future legislative bodies in our approach. Can you give us any kind of perspective from the administration on spending limits? Because I believe that there's interest at this table about a spending limit to control that upward movement of overall operating budget.
Senator McKinnon, Madam Chairwoman, I don't think I can tell you exactly where the administration is on the idea. I can tell you that in the initial stages of the Permanent Fund Protection Act, we looked at a whole number of different ways to address the volatility issue, and one of them was a more broadly defined revenue or spending limit. But ultimately, we had a difficult time doing it in such a way that it was really effective. I mean, I think you see that with the existing constitutional amendment and some of the other, spending limits that are on the books. It's just hard to write them and define them in a way that they operate well. So that was one of the reasons that we chose to really focus addressing volatility and creating a limit on, the three largest cash flows, which are your earnings, your royalties, and your production taxes. This is just because we had a hard time making it work.
Thank you. Senator Bishop.
Well, I'll just make a little comment on spending limits. I think if this was to become law and every man, woman, and child in Alaska had this by their computer on their refrigerator, for this thing to work, you kind of got a spending limit.
People of Alaska definitely are interested in government spending more than any time before when there's conversations about limiting or reducing their dividend checks. So we absolutely are treading lightly on the conversation. Senator Dunleavy.
Mr. Chair, is it the administration's position today, if a model such as what we're discussing today is adopted, that the tax concept will not be pushed this year? Or is it still the plan of the administration to push taxes in conjunction with this a model such as this on the permanent fund?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair. So I haven't heard any discussion from the governor about doing anything other than proposing all of his elements of his original plan. So it's my understanding that, he's still pushing for and hoping for, his full package in terms of, what he proposed in terms of budget cuts and revenues and restructuring of the permanent fund. But I also am certainly not going to speak for the governor here either. So in terms of outside of the piece of the permanent fund.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us today in Senate Finance. Our last presenter this afternoon is Angela Rodell. Ms. Rodell, if you could approach the microphone. Place yourself on the record and provide us some feedback on the CS. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Angela Rodell. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Our role in working on the CS has basically been to make sure that we understand all of the mechanics of how your intent is to have this work. We are prepared to do what we can and coordinate with revenue. I think one of the things for us that has been most helpful is to have the flexibility to work with the Department of Revenue on cash management so that, as the Commissioner stated in his remarks, they only draw when they need the cash because they have cash coming in every single day, and so being able to work with them and manage that and not have it set out in specific language is very helpful to us and to the Department of Revenue, so I appreciate that. I also appreciate the addition of the procurement language, which will make it much more, it'll help us to pursue investments in a much more timely fashion than we've been able to in the past, so I want to thank the committee for that as well. But other than that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Rodell, on your last comments and changing the procurement codes, and if we go down this road and you're now handling the CBR funds, and the commissioner spoke about that, I'm not quoting verbatim, but the net and the fees against the CBR fund, and there might have to be an RSA between the two departments. My question is, the more funds that the more cash that your shop has to work with, does your management fees, do you get a discount, or you know what I'm saying, with your money managers?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the quick answer is it depends. So it depends on the investment. So those things that are internally managed, like fixed income or real estate, those fees are what they are, and so the fees would be lower for the Constitutional Budget Reserve because it doesn't matter the size of the assets under management because our internal staffing budget is what it is. Externally managed accounts tend to have fee schedules attached to them that as they get more under management, they adjust based on how much more comes under management, so they tend to have thresholds of management fee. So the quick answer to your question is it'll depend, but there may be some efficiencies on the fees.
Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? Closing comments. Ms. Rodell.
Madam Chair, I don't really have any closing comments other than to say it's a very interesting bill and we're ready to do whatever you guys ask of us.
Ms. Rodell, I have a question. You're the former Revenue Commissioner, and so I know that you're sensitive and this is our idea, not someone else's. And we've been talking about it for a while. Actually, I think we talked about it when you were Revenue Commissioner. And when you were Revenue Commissioner, I think we had a year where you beat the permanent fund in return. Am I remembering that accurately?
Madam Chair, I believe there was a year where the Retirement Management Board asset performance was better than the permanent fund.
And so I'm wondering, is there value in the diversification of who's investing the money versus all under one? I mean, we've got to ask the question, and we should do it publicly. We have two groups managing who compete, and the permanent fund has secured Alaska's individual Alaskans' dividends, so there's a high level of confidence in your wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. And they may not, Alaskans may not be aware that in operation of state government, commissioners of revenue have done an outstanding job in utilizing and investing those assets also, but they may need those assets much quicker, and so they get a lower rate of return, maybe more often than not, based on they need liquidity, which is driving down returns. So is there anything that the legislature should consider as we're pondering this particular situation, trying to, again, consolidate and not have duplication of services and manage those services in one, I want to say shed. It's much nicer than a shed, but it's very prestigious to work in Alaska's Permanent Fund Corporation. So can you just talk to me about that for a minute?
Madam Chair, I think there's two sort of things going on here. One is the recognition that as Commissioner of Revenue, you have fiduciary responsibility for all of the state's financial assets. So you're a trustee to the Permanent Fund, you're a trustee to the retirement funds, and you have sole fiduciary responsibility to the state funds, whether it's the Constitutional Budget Reserve, Statutory Budget Reserve, or the general funds. And I think having that continuity of viewpoint is very helpful. There is benefit in some ways to diversification, but I think it's more diversification of asset allocation as opposed to the individual running a particular portfolio. And what the Commissioner of Revenue does in their role is they bring that viewpoint of asset allocation versus a particular portfolio manager's viewpoint. One of the things that the Commissioner of Revenue and I are working on, and we have started the process, is to do a review as requested and to look at whether or not there's opportunities to generate additional returns on financial assets to the state and create operational efficiencies at the same time. And so we'll continue to look at that without running the risk that concentrations create their own set of risk and that there will be problems down the road that we didn't foresee.
Questions from committee members?
I just have one question, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Rodal, as you look at the plan here, what does it do to your, I mean, I look at you as an optimistic person who's overcome some pretty big hurdles in your life, and as you look at the plan here, what does this do to your optimism when you look at this bill versus the other bills that have been presented?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I think probably the concern, and it's been raised around the table, is are we cutting it too close? Are we going too high, the 5.25%, or taking out? But I will say that one of the things in the legislative intent is the three-year look at the use of earnings. The committee may want to think about expanding on that a little bit and say, do we want to specifically state, we'll look at the 5.25%, and are we look at the distribution of income, and do we want to make sure that we're reviewing everything within the bill, not just the use of earnings every 3 years to ensure that we're not taking money too quickly out of the earnings reserve. We'll do our level best to make as much money as is prudent, but there's no guarantees, and I guess that's what I want to make sure on the record, that we all remember that markets can be very fickle at times, and so we will do our best given the market conditions as they warrant.
Thank you. Ms. Riddell, I was in Anchorage and watched the presentation from, I believe you had three presentations, or maybe it was just two. No, it's three. The governor presented to the board their ideas for use of our assets. Senator McGuire was there, and she presented, and as well as a representative from the other body. And I saw all the models and the runs from the actuaries that support the Permanent Fund Board. And so my question is, does the board meet again anytime soon so they can look at this CS, what we're proposing, to see if there's any official board comments? Or is there another way that we can solicit information from the board itself on the move that we're contemplating right now?
Madam Chair, the next regularly scheduled board meeting is scheduled for May 24th and 25th, so I really hope that you will be done before that board meeting. No promises. I understand. Having said that, the board feels that it's very important to recognize and respect their role in this as trustees, which is to manage the funds of the corpus. What the policy is by the administration and the legislature as to how those earnings get used is entirely up to you, and we recognize your authority in that matter, and we will support whatever decision comes out and do our best to and implement the changes.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Rodell. With that, I would like to publicly thank again Attorney General Richards for his cooperation and efforts in trying to work on a CS between both of the bodies. I think that we're further along on this particular proposal as far as working towards a solution to present to Alaskans in a final form and then have a debate on that. I want to thank Commissioner Hoffbeck. When he was originally standing in front of us for confirmation, I suggested I didn't appreciate one of his actions. I just want to say publicly that I was wrong, that the action turned out to be to Alaska's best interest, in Alaska's best interest, and I very much I want to say that out loud because if I make a mistake or if I say something that's not right, I want to get it back on the record. And so it could have been a bad move, but it wasn't. And I believe I said it on the floor. It was made in the best interest of Alaskans, but I was afraid that that big of a money move at one time scared me. But I'm glad it worked out for Alaskans. With that, do we brief at ease? We're back on the record. Gentlemen, I just was trying to make sure that we had a path forward. My staff and I, because of the 3 a.m. meeting, have not had the length of time of yesterday's floor session hasn't provided me an opportunity to sit down to map out how to go forward for the next little bit. We would like that little bit to be a small path. So if it's okay with you, I'd like to schedule a 10 a.m. meeting tomorrow, and I will notice what's on that 10 a.m. meeting if we can get speakers together to move us forward. If not, we may have a day's delay in being able to get speakers in front of us. Senator Machicki.
When you get to closing comments, and I'm sure you know it's like earlier meetings, but and I know you do as well, but you're struggling to get speakers here, so yeah.
Thank you. Anything else?
I have, Madam Chair, I have two things I want to say. One of them is we keep talking about downward pressure, and frankly, at some point, you're going to get to where there's growth in your government, right? And we know there's plenty of room to reduce, but you can't reduce forever. And those of us with a municipal background know we pushed our cities to where they're using pencils until they can't hold them anymore. Because we've run municipalities on nothing for a long period of time, and at some point you have natural escalation as inflation hits the cost of your city. So you can't retract and contract on what you spend your city forever. And it's just important for Alaskans to realize when we talk about bloated governments, we've reduced pretty significantly over the last 4 years. Definitely room to reduce further, but at some point you have to plan for an increase in the cost of your government. Maybe that's 5 years from now, maybe it's 10, I don't know, but it's going to happen, and that should be a part of the model that we consider. And then, Madam Chair, I meant to say this while the administration was up here, but the governor talked about a plan that was written in pencil, and I actually praise him for laying something out there that's not politically popular, and that's tough. That takes some guts. But the governor talked about $100 million in cuts. If you want to give him full credit for those cuts, and I don't mean that to sound unkind, but you know, we're 400% of that. We're shifting some of those levers around, and I just hope the administration stays flexible because we're taking some big jumps here. We've done significantly higher cuts than the administration had planned to make, and we're trying to cover that gap in different ways, Madam Chair, and it likely will not result in a broad-based tax this year. I'm certainly not there. And I just want to make that clear. I'm happy to talk about the other smaller revenue bills that are on the table. I just wanted to say that publicly for the administration to hear that we may get there filling different lines in different ways, and I hope they take that into account. All of these are big bills. We've had some monumental savings bills that we've laid on the table, and we've cut fairly significantly. So I just hope to hear that.
Senator Dunleavy.
No questions.
Anyone else? With that, 10 a.m. tomorrow, we're adjourned.